The next case on for oral argument this morning is State of Minnesota versus Darla. Counsel, each of you will have 15 minutes to present your arguments in chief and an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel for rebuttal if you choose to use that time. The time restrictions are indicated in the podium, so please be mindful of those restrictions as you're making your arguments. And the podium, by the way, can be elevated and lowered. There's a button right in front that allows you to match the lectern to your height. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument, because we keep track of the arguments in our audio recording of the proceedings. Counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Good morning. My name is Chip Granger, and I'm the Assistant Dakota County Attorney representing the appellant in this case. I'm asking you to reverse the sentencing court's sentencing order and remand the case for resentencing with an order that adjudication cannot be stayed. Even applying the clear abuse of discretion standard, as this court has done in the past, the sentencing court clearly did not have the authority and abused its discretion by staying adjudication of respondent's sentence. Minnesota Statute 152.18, which gives sentencing courts the authority to stay adjudication in some circumstances, did not apply to the defendant's case at the time the offense was committed, the time the case was charged, or at the time of sentencing. So clearly, the court did not have authority under that statute to stay adjudication of the respondent's sentence. Respondent argues that charging respondent with the Pre-Drug Sentencing Reform Act second-degree possession statute was a clear abuse of the charging discretion. However, the law is very clear that the Drug Sentencing Reform Act second-degree possession statute only applies to crimes committed on or after August 1st of 2016. The Minnesota Supreme Court in State versus Otto held that the weight thresholds in the Drug Sentencing Reform Act did not apply retroactively to offenses committed prior to August 1st, 2016, and denied Otto's request to have the severity of his offense reduced because of the increased weight thresholds. Therefore, there clearly was no abuse of the prosecutorial charging discretion in this case.
So one of the arguments I see in the brief by respondent is that the prosecutor in this case did abuse its charging discretion because it could have charged Mr. Darling under the revised statute. I understand your argument about the chronology, the Kirby, the Otto case, all of that, but is that true? The prosecutor could have?
No, Your Honor, because that revised statute did not apply to the defendant's offense. The defendant's offense was committed, I believe, in July 11th. I know it was July of 2016. I don't believe the exact date. That new revised...
Your view is that based on the date of the offense, the prosecutor had no discretion as to
charge it, right, because the statute specifically said, and the Court of Appeals confirmed that in Otto, that the statute regarding the weights did not apply retroactively.
Well, I don't think Otto made the, as I read it, but please help me if I've got it wrong, I don't think that the Supreme Court stated that there would be no basis for reversal of a conviction based on the change in the weights. Because I think we all are on the same page that had Mr. Darling committed his offense after the DSRA went into effect,
correct,
he would not have been charged with second degree, right? And I think the reference was to probably fifth degree.
Correct.
Because of these changes in the weight restrictions.
Correct.
And Otto rejected the idea that someone like Mr. Otto was entitled to have his conviction overturned based on the changes
but
in the DSRA.
The statute.
My question's a little different. It's asking you whether the prosecutor could have charged Mr. Otto under the new.
And I don't think that would have been appropriate because assuming you charge, assuming hypothetically that the prosecutor did charge him under that new statute, so that it would be a fifth degree. That statute clearly says that it is effective August 1st of 2016. So it, the defendant doesn't show for court, a warrant goes out for his arrest.
Right, but we have charges that weren't filed here until quite a bit later, right?
About 8 months after, I believe it was.
Yeah, well after the new DSRA right. Act was in effect, correct?
Correct. Yeah. But assuming that he would have been charged with that new statute, the defendant doesn't show up for court. A warrant is issued for his arrest. 3 years after the date of the offense, the statute of limitations runs. Assume he's picked up 3 years and 1 day or thereafter, after the date of the offense. He can come in and say, this statute doesn't apply to me. It applies to crimes that are committed on or after August 1st of 2016. It's not charged correctly. Judge dismisses the case because this case, the statute doesn't apply to the defendant because his offense occurred prior to the effective date of that statute.
Counsel. Doesn't the state sort of always have the ability to undercharge? So in other words, even if the state takes the position that it was bound to apply the earlier statute, and even though it was a second degree amount under the earlier statute, what prevents the state under those circumstances from saying, we're nonetheless going to charge this as a fifth degree?
I could have charged him fifth degree. I could have charged him third.
So the answer is, yes, you had the state had discretion to charge this as a fifth degree. Nothing prevented the state from doing it under the law that applied to the charging decision. The issue is, was that an abuse of prosecutorial discretion in charging simply because under the new law, a fifth degree charge would have been mandated?
Right, but I mean, there's no obligation on a prosecutor to undercharge the cases. And we didn't undercharge. The statute required at the time this offense was committed that it be 6 or more grams. The defendant had, I believe it was 6.96, almost a full gram over. That's why he was charged with the second degree in this case. The respondent also argued in his brief that at the time of sentencing, he was sober, seeing a counselor, looking for employment, and trying to rebuild his life. But there's no evidence that at the time this case was charged, or even assuming hypothetically that that's true, that he made that aware to the prosecutor. We weren't aware of him rebuilding his life. I don't think there's any evidence that shows he was rebuilding his life at the time of the charging of this case. It was after the case was commenced that the defendant started going to treatment and trying to rehabilitate his life, not at the time of charging. So based upon those arguments, there is no clear abuse of discretion in this case.
Are you conceding that if the information was available and this occurred, the rehabilitative efforts had occurred at the time of charging and the prosecutor was aware of it, that it would be an abuse of discretion to have charged under the more, as the state charged?
No, but that's what the defense is, I interpret their respondent is arguing in his brief, that we should have undercharged because of those rehabilitative efforts. And even if we would have been aware of those and true, I don't believe we've got the obligation. But my point is, there's nothing in the record to indicate that at the time of charging, he was taking those steps to rehabilitate his life, doing treatment. And if, in fact, he was doing that, it wasn't made aware to the state, at least at the time of charging. Therefore, I'm asking that this court remand the case for sentencing with an order that the sentencing court cannot stay the adjudication, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Does the state have an objection? There was the PSI recommended a stay of imposition, right?
Correct.
The guidelines would be a stay of execution. do you see that there would have been any abuse of discretion to grant a stay of imposition as opposed to an execution? So you're not making that argument?
I'm not. I agree the court had the discretion to do a stay of imposition. I was asking for a stay of execution, but I agree she did have the discretion to do a stay of imposition, but not a stay of adjudication. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court. My name is Kristen Chapman. I'm an assistant state public defender, and I represent respondent Brent Darling. This court should affirm the district court's order staying adjudication of Mr. Darling's guilt because it is a proper exercise of the court's inherent judicial authority to do so. And I would like to start by addressing some of the issues raised during appellant's argument.
So by beginning with the inherent judicial authority, which is how I read your brief too, it seems to me that you are not disagreeing with the state on the first argument that they make, which is that this court had no statutory authority to stay adjudication.
Correct, Your Honor. Although Mr. Darling was not technically entitled to a stay under Minnesota Statute 152.18.
Well, not technically, not at all, right? There are three situations I think the statute recognizes, and none of them apply to Mr. Darling, right?
Yes.
Okay.
But I do find the court's order of a stay adjudication under that statute is further evidence of the court's implicit finding that the prosecutor abused his charging discretion.
How did the, just to make sure I'm clear, if your argument is it was in the district court's inherent authority to stay adjudication, we have to conclude that the prosecutor abused his or her charging discretion. How was there an abuse of charging discretion here? When you've got Supreme Court case law saying that these charges, this new statute in terms of weight requirements for first and second degree, only apply to crimes committed on or after this date. How did the prosecutor abuse his discretion by following the plain language of the statute as interpreted by the Supreme Court in Otto?
The prosecutor abused his charging discretion in this case, and we're not arguing that Otto controls in this situation. He did it in the face of public policy that had been established through the passing of the DSRA.
You're saying you're not arguing that Otto controls or doesn't control?
I'm not arguing that the prosecutor was required under Otto to charge Mr. Darling with a fifth-degree possession. The argument is, in the face of the DSRA, the prosecutor had the public policy reasons behind the DSRA.
To undercharge.
And this case
is
unique.
If that obligation is placed on the prosecutor, why was Otto decided the way it was? I mean, if the public policies underlying the DSRA are so strong that we shouldn't have anyone getting convicted under the old statute, why didn't the Supreme Court go that way? You seem to be saying, well, the prosecutor is required to grant relief as a matter of public policy, even though the Supreme Court has said, no, that's not necessary because of how the legislature wrote the law.
And I believe Mr. Darling's case is unique and distinct from Otto, because although the offense occurred shortly before the DSR changes that increased the substance abuse weight thresholds, he was not charged until almost 8 months after the law took effect. So at the time that the prosecutor made the charging decision, the DSRA, those amendments had been in effect. The public policy concerns and the shift in the law was known by the prosecutor, yet the prosecutor still chose to charge Mr. Darling under the harsher pre-DSRA second-degree possession.
I don't understand why you believe it's the public policy of the state to undercharge when the public policy is reflected in the statute designating the dates, the effective dates of the amended statute. Why aren't the dates part of the public policy?
Here, because the charge...
If the legislature had the public policy of retroactive application, the legislature would have indicated that public policy in determining the dates. Instead, the legislature defined a different approach. So why isn't that the public policy of the state?
I think if we look at the dates and also consider the other public policy reasons for the DSRA changes, that drug users should be treated differently from drug dealers, that mitigating punishment for drug users is in the benefit of public safety.
Beginning with a certain date.
Correct.
So I want you to focus on the date. What you're saying that it's the general public policy as if that public policy applies retroactively to all time. I mean, under your argument, I would suppose a defendant who's been previously convicted before the statute was ever enacted, could bring a habeas petition or argue that the statute must be retroactively applied as a matter of policy. I think Otto defeats that. But I guess my question is focused on this point, that the legislature defined a date that initiates the effectiveness of the statute. Why isn't that date part of the state's public policy?
And I understand that the legislature provided a date, and that was August 1st, 2016. However, I think it is important in this case that Mr. Darling was not charged until after that date.
But the legislature could have established a date that was based on the time of charging. It didn't. It established a date that's based on the date of commission of the alleged offense. So why isn't what the prosecutor did completely consistent with the legislative policy set forth in the statute and endorsed in Otto?
Because I think by focusing solely on the date, it ignores the other public policy reasons here.
But the legislature focused on the date. The legislature offered the date. The legislature told prosecutors, be aware of this date and it's implying, it seems to me necessarily, make your charging decisions based on the date. What's wrong with that logic?
And I think that logic doesn't give full weight to the other public policy concerns that led to those drug law changes. And again, this isn't a case—
Are you suggesting the legislature wasn't aware of those other public policy concerns when it wrote its law?
No, Your Honor, I'm not suggesting that. What I'm suggesting is, in the unique situation of Mr. Darling's case, it's not a case that was pending on appeal when the drug law took effect, and then there was the issue, like an auto, of trying to get the benefit of that drug law. This was a case that did not begin until well after those laws took effect. And the prosecutor had discretion to charge Mr. Darling with a lower offense that would have allowed the court to issue a stay of adjudication under 152.18.
And I think we've established, the prosecutor agrees, he could have done that. But how could we conclude that it was an abuse of charging discretion to have not done that when the decision that was made is consistent with the plain language of the statute and the decision in Otto? How do we say the prosecutor abused his discretion in charging when what he did is completely consistent with existing law?
Yes, Your Honor. And my argument to that would be, although technically allowed under the law, and the prosecutor can charge it under the law, the point of prosecutorial discretion is that they have discretion to make that choice, and they can choose to undercharge. And as I cite in my brief, the ABA lays out standards of conduct for prosecutors and lists different factors that prosecutors should consider when making charging decisions. Just because a prosecutor can charge—
Which of those factors are relevant to the argument you're making here?
Four specific factors that I highlight in my brief. The changes in law and policy is a factor specifically recognized by the ABA. The impact on the public welfare, the offender's voluntary efforts at rehabilitation, and the collateral consequences of the conviction.
Was it just going to appellant's point on the third factor? When did the prosecutor first become aware of the rehabilitative efforts of your client?
Your Honor, based on the record, from what I can tell, in the PSI, there are mentions of attending Narcotics Anonymous meetings. At sentencing, there was evidence I am not sure if the prosecutor knew before sentencing or before the PSI.
Well, before charging is my question.
I am not aware of any information that indicates the prosecutor knew before charging. However,
the factor doesn't matter, does it, when it comes to the prosecutor's charging discretion?
I disagree, Your Honor. I think it does matter because the prosecutor always has the opportunity to amend charges throughout the course of a case. Part of the charging discretion is the discretion to offer a plea agreement, to reduce charges, to dismiss charges, and that goes throughout the pendency of the case. I think also at sentencing, although the court had already made a finding of guilt as to a second-degree possession, the prosecutor has discretion when it comes to sentencing arguments, or the prosecutor could have agreed to the stay of adjudication as within the court's inherent judicial authority in that situation. Additionally, I think an example of the complete lack of discretion that was exercised in charging Mr. Darling and maintaining the charge as a second-degree possession was the prosecutor's argument at sentencing that Mr. Darling should be sentenced to a year-long jail term. And that was based on a misunderstanding of the applicable guidelines at the time of Mr. Darling's offense. At the time of Mr. Darling's offense, the post-DSRA guidelines applied. There was no reason for the Kirby analysis because the changes to the guidelines were effective May 23rd, 2016. But at sentencing, the prosecutor argued, based on the misunderstanding that the old guidelines applied, simply because that was the state of the law then, Mr. Darling should be sent to prison for a year. That was in the face of knowing the information about Mr. Darling being sober, doing drug treatment, substance abuse treatment, trying to find a job, trying to rebuild his life and become a productive member of society.
Is the argument you're making sort of based on a case-by-case determination of which defendants deserve to be undercharged? Or is your argument essentially, well, this is a policy, prosecutors should recognize this policy change, and therefore when they find themselves in a position where they need to charge an offense that predates the DRSA, that they should undercharge consistent with the new legislation?
I think both of those is the case here, Your Honor. I think it is fact-specific, and the policy change plays into the specific facts of Mr. Darling's case.
Well, that seems to me, if you're saying that this is how all prosecutors should treat all people who end up in this charging position, I think that flies in the face of the statute in Otto. You're essentially saying, well, we're not going to do what the legislature said and what the Supreme Court said. Instead, we're going to expect prosecutors to undercharge in order to get around that on or after August 1 deadline. And we're going to do that as a matter of the judicial district court stating what the law should be.
And respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree. I think looking at the specific facts of Mr. Darling's case, that result was warranted, and it's for several reasons, including the timing.
So it's case-specific, not across the board.
Correct, Your Honor. I think Mr. Darling's case is unique, given the timing of his offense shortly before the law took effect.
But couldn't there be a lot of people who were, you know, arrested shortly before the date of effect, and the reports didn't get forwarded to the prosecutor, and the offense didn't get charged until after the effective date? That doesn't seem all that unusual.
Perhaps, Your Honor, but I would highlight the 8-month delay. Additionally, I would also highlight...
Why does the 8-month delay matter?
I think it's a different frame of reference when you have this law that's been in place for 8 months. The public policy reasons are known versus maybe a charge that had been in the works and happened, you know, on August 2nd. Additionally, Your Honor, I do think that we don't know what happens in this case in other situations. I have not seen any cases on this or have personal knowledge of that, but I don't think it's unreasonable to think that a prosecutor would have exercised discretion and undercharged in that situation. And I don't have that information that has occurred, but I don't think that's an unreasonable presumption.
So, counsel, I have a little different question. I understand your policy arguments for why you feel that this prosecutor abused his charging discretion, but guess what troubles me in reviewing the district court's decision is we don't have a determination by our district court that the prosecutor clearly abused his charging discretion. So on what basis does this court affirm what was done, the stay of adjudication in this case, when we don't have such a finding? I mean, I know you've argued that there should be an implicit finding made. We do occasionally make implicit findings. This seems to be an awfully big one to make. And on what basis would we do that?
Mm-hmm. Yes, Your Honor. First, I don't think the fact that the district court did not make an express finding is fatal to the district court's decision and to our argument. In Foss, the court clearly looked at the record as a whole when reversing the district court. The court expressly said nothing in the record supports an abuse of charging discretion finding, and so we reverse. In this case, the reasons provided by the district court describe an abuse of the prosecutorial charging function. Specifically, the court notes that had the offense occurred a short time later, it would have been a fifth degree, and under the amended post-DSRA laws, it would have been a mandatory stay of adjudication under 152.18. The district court also notes that Kirby talked about resentencing people with convictions and that the laws had recently changed. The Kirby opinion talks about the public policy reasons behind the DSRA. So clearly the court was considering those reasons when implicitly finding that the prosecutor...
You'd point me to the Foss case.
Yes.
As the best example of where this court, or I guess that would be the Supreme Court, I think, has accepted an implicit determination prosecutorial abuse of discretion. So our court in State v. Martin, and I know you're familiar with it, you cited it in your brief, you critiqued its analysis of the standard of review, took a quite different approach, where the argument was made to uphold the sentence based on a clear abuse of prosecutorial discretion. This court refused to do that, saying no finding by the district court.
And, Your Honor,
and why shouldn't we take that approach?
Because I believe that was a misreading of the Lee opinion. The Lee opinion, and I know I'm short on running out of time. May I continue my answer?
Well, you still have time, so.
Okay. The Lee opinion was clearly, the intent of the Lee opinion was to reconcile any confusion caused between the Kreutzer and the Foss opinion. And the Lee court did that and said.
Effectively abrogated Kreutzer, didn't it?
Correct, Your Honor, and said, Foss did not mean to say special circumstances or clear abuse of discretion. It is only clear abuse of discretion. The Lee court then expressly stated that, therefore, we affirm the standard we announce in Foss. And then the court goes on to note in the same sentence, clear abuse of the prosecutorial charging function must be found. However, if you look at the Foss opinion, that is nowhere in the opinion. So, although the Lee court was purporting to simply affirm, not change or add any requirements to the Foss opinion, it did. So I would urge this court, and I believe the Martin court should have, disregarded that language in Lee because it's internally inconsistent with the rest of the opinion, and it's inconsistent with the Foss opinion.
Although your time's expired, I'm going to ask you a yes or no question.
Okay.
I didn't see any cited in your brief, and perhaps after you wrote your brief, you came upon some support, but I'm curious whether you've come upon any case in Minnesota or elsewhere, where a prosecutor's discretionary choice not to undercharge a defendant was held to be an abuse of the prosecutor's discretion.
No, but may I explain?
Well, I'm not sure how you would explain, but the negative answer to that question, but give it a run.
Well, I believe
briefly
in Kreutzer and Latimer, which has been abrogated on certain grounds, it was essentially a finding that the prosecutor should have never brought charges in the first place. So although those cases have been abrogated and it wasn't an undercharge situation, it was essentially that with saying this is not a situation where the prosecutor should have brought charges.
Thank you. Counsel for Appellant.
Chip Granger, Assistant Dakota County Attorney, on behalf of the appellant. The respondent disagrees and the judge disagrees with the charging decision, but disagreement does not rise to the level of abuse of discretion, which is required for this court to reverse the sentence or to affirm the sentence. With respect to the Kirby decision, that was taken into account in the sentencing by staying execution of the sentence in this case. The Kirby decision said that the new sentencing guidelines did apply. That's why it was done as the stay of execution as opposed to a executed sentence. And then I'd be happy to try to answer any other questions that may have arisen during the respondent's oral argument.
Doesn't appear there
are
any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Granger. Ms. Chapman, the matter is well briefed. We appreciate your briefing and your oral argument, and it is submitted. We'll issue our opinion within the statutory period. Thank you. Although the court is not in recess at this time, we're going to take a moment to reconstitute the panel.